Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa.
Welcome to Third Paradigm, an out-of-the-box think tank on community sovereignty and regenerative economics. We look at how to take back our cities, farmland and water, our money, production and trade, our media, education and culture, our religion and even our God. We present a people's history of the Bible and a parent's view on how to raise giving kids in a taking world. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting through Free Radio Santa Cruz and Upstart Radio Online.
Don't need convincing at all. I love this place enough to have no doubt. Whoa, whoa.
Welcome to the 24th episode of Third Paradigm. Our title this week is We Interrupt This Commercial. Radio and television have become long segments promoting a consumer lifestyle, broken up by shorter, explicit commercials about specific products. In the following piece, we'll look at a book called The Soap Opera Paradigm by James H. Wittebolz. Wittebolz illuminates the origins of marketing-driven media in the serial radio drama. Personally, I thought that radio and TV had always been entertainment sponsored by and for a profit. My biggest surprise was finding out that wasn't the norm when radio and TV began. As we look at how our expectations for journalism and integrity have been lowered, it's notable that we the people wanted and recognized high quality before junk media, like junk food, hooked us on predigested bursts of quick sensations. Media is now the simple carbohydrate of the mind, empty calories, fostering a lazy metabolism. But first, I'd like to continue the conversation that we're having in the independent media. I picture this like a big long dinner table where the guests may disagree on strategy, but respect each other and share the same goal. In a sense, it's a way of talking out loud to yourself, except through different people. This week, Democracy Now! Addressed one of my topics last week, how to define a human right. Senator Christine Kaufman of Montana has introduced a bill to recognize health care as a universal human right. Amy asked her what she meant by that. She said it means that it's something that's just part of what we get as citizens in this country. Excuse me, Senator, but universal and citizens of this country don't mean the same thing. If something is a universal human right, all people in the world are entitled to it equally, not those who are citizens of one state or one country. In this sense, single-payer health care is as much a market-based solution as that of Senator Max Baucus, whose solution is to mandate insurance coverage. With single-payer, we who live in a moneyed economy would fund the exorbitant cost of health care and pharmaceuticals by raising taxes, socializing the cost, capitalizing the profit. We would also pay for litigation when we fail to extend lives as long as possible. I just got a notice that the schools are being driven to a 2% furlough next year and cutting learning assistants, reading specialists, library assistants, classroom materials, arts coordinators, life lab instructors, custodial time, and office machine maintenance. What else would we cut to fund health care? There is another solution. What if we made the patenting of food or medicine illegal? What if we said that all knowledge beneficial to humanity could never be withheld in order to extract profit? Let's debunk intellectual property rights as colonizing the mind as the last frontier. Without IP rights, South Africa could make its own antiretrovirals and cures for yellow fever. Immunizations in the U.S. would drop from $1,000 to less than $100. Medical research would dry up, but so what? Let's implement the cures we already have but don't produce. That would be consistent with medicine as a universal human right, not just for citizens of the empire. If we wanted to bring the cost of healthcare down, we could create an insurance that gave all unused funds each year to Partners in Health, NGO of the legendary Paul Farmer. That would make doctors and patients partners in creating profit that served humanity, who wanted quality of life, not to argue with God about the quantity. It's not our right to be taken care of. It's our right to take care of ourselves without taking that right away from anyone else. I just heard homeless advocates and college students in Sacramento chanting that food, clothes, education, and shelter were human rights. They weren't asking for the land to be farmers, or the tools to produce clothes, or the material to build houses. No, these things appear of their own accord, dropped from the sky as human rights. This Earth Week, let's not insult those who work it by saying the products of their labor are our right. I'll now read a poem by John O'Donohue called In Praise of the Earth. The music is Cinematic Orchestra with Evolution. In Praise of the Earth. Let us bless the imagination of the earth that knew early the patience to harness the mind of time, waited for the seas to warm, ready to welcome the emergence of things dreaming of voyaging among the stillness of land. And how light knew to nurse the growth until the face of the earth brightened beneath a vision of color. When the ages of ice came and sealed the earth inside an endless coma of cold, the heart of the earth held hope, storing fragments of memory, ready for the return of the sun. Let us thank the earth that offers ground for home and holds our feet firm to walk in space open to infinite galaxies. Let us salute the silence and certainty of mountains, their sublime stillness, their dream-filled hearts. The wonder of a garden, trusting the first warmth of spring until its black infinity of cells becomes charged with dream. Then the silent, slow nurture of the seed self, coaxing it to trust the act of death. The humility of the earth that transfigures all that has fallen of outlived growth. The kindness of the earth, opening to receive our worn forms into the final stillness. Let us ask forgiveness of the earth for all our sins against her, for our violence and poisonings of her beauty. Let us remember within us the ancient clay, holding the memory of seasons, the passion of the wind, the fluency of water, the warmth of fire, the quiver touch of the sun, and shadowed sureness of the moon. That we may awaken to live to the full, the dream of the earth who chose us to emerge and incarnate its hidden night in mind, spirit, and light. That was the late or the early John O'Donohue with In Praise of the Earth from his final volume, To Bless the Space Between Us. The music was Cinematic Orchestra with Evolution from their Man with a Movie Camera CD. Donohue asked that we may awaken to live to the full the dream of the earth. Last night, I attended an event called Awakening the Dreamer, Changing the Dream, put on by the Pachamama Alliance, which means Mother Earth in Quechua, the indigenous language of Ecuador. They showed an inspiring video with footage from Julia Butterfly Hill, Paul Hawken, Lynn and Bill Twist, Thich Nhat Hanh, and Desmond Tutu. It included excerpts from The Story of Stuff, The One Earth Wombat, and quotes from Vaclav Havel and Emerson. The audience was also impressive and included many people becoming familiar from these many meetings, motivational events, empowerment workshops, and rapport-building exercises. At this point, we know we're the ones we've been waiting for. But what's our strategy? For myself, I'm ready to put some flesh on this dream. But in the meantime, we'll hear from Bird York, who also had a dream.
Here comes undone. Says he lost the map his life was on. Says everything is unraveling. I take his hand and then I kiss him like the world is ending and say, where logic ends, faith begins.
That was Bird York with Had a Dream from her incomparable CD, Wicked Little High. If you don't know her, she's a very nuanced and edgy, which is refreshing in a genre that tends to the new agey. Speaking of birds, I've been incubating eggs for the last 3 weeks. As I told my friend that I was chalking it up to a learning experience because nothing was going to hatch, an egg cheeped. We now have 9 rare breed chicks at our house. Some have feathered feet, and 2 have mullets. However, those puffballs that seem to be on top of their heads actually are their heads, which reminds me of Naomi Klein's recent newsletters, Brain Bubbles and Hope Hangovers. It's very funny. To continue her joke, I think I'll name my 2 brain bubble birds, Larry Summers and Alan Greenspan. But let's go back from brain bubbles to soap bubbles. The Soap Opera Paradigm, James Whittable's well-researched book on television programming and corporate priorities. I would say that it's also very entertaining, but I don't want to demean it. One of the points that fascinated me was about the early days of radio, subtitled Who Owns the Airwaves? It details how a U.S. government corporate consortium, the Radio Corporation of America, or RCA, secured a monopoly on all the patents for broadcast and reception. During World War I, the military maintained exclusive control over radio with sponsorships by its partners, United Fruit, GE, AT&T, and Westinghouse. But among the public, there was general agreement that the airwaves were a resource to be managed for the common good, with strong representation by nonprofit, educational, and spiritual interests. In 1924, over 240 college and non-commercial radio stations were operating along with amateur radio operators. In 1927, the Federal Radio Commission, or FRC, was established as a traffic cop for broadcast licenses. Their technical standards put many educational stations out of business, but radio was still mandated to serve the public interest, convenience, and necessity. The debate between public and commercial came to a boil with the Hatfield-Wagner Amendment, which would have required that 25% of licenses be non-commercial, guaranteeing labor, church, farming, and other civic interest a part of the spectrum. Instead, the act that passed said that network owners would only study the proposal. We all know how that ended. Yet up until the late 70s, news was seen as a fulfillment of this mandate to serve the public interest. They weren't expected to be profit centers. CBS, in particular, strove to be the New York Times of TV, with quality documentaries like Harvest of Shame about migrant workers and the selling of the Pentagon. Generally, the goal was to give news viewers what they needed in order to be citizens in a democracy, not necessarily what they wanted. CBS prohibited music, visual recreations, news stories sympathetic to advertisers, and sensationalism. The standards handbook maintained, "This may make us a little less interesting to some, but that is the price we pay for dealing with fact and truth." Reuven Frank's book, Out of Thin Air, details the efforts made for substantive, in-depth reporting challenging the government, as Edward R. Murrow did, and powerful institutions and corporations. Distinct from the news, back in the Great Depression, soap operas were designed to extend the broadcast day and sell detergent to homemakers. They were an advertiser's dream, inexpensive to produce, and not only carried ads, but placed products in the story, featuring celebrity and actor endorsements. Soon, the programs themselves were produced by the ad agencies. It was cheap entertainment, a respite from the daily grind of making a living. This was relatively harmless, but the thesis of the soap opera paradigm is that all programming has come to follow the model, starting with sports and leading to coverage of news, disasters, and primaries, not to mention primetime and reality TV. What are the market-critical elements of soap operas? First, they're a serial narrative that uses teasers and cliffhangers to promote continued consumption of future episodes. Second, they have a real-time orientation, so time passes in the story and for the viewer at the same pace, mimicking reality. Third, they bring the viewer intimately into a community of surrogate friends. Fourth, the viewer is omniscient, is allowed inside the characters' heads, the ultimate in with the in-group. Lastly, they draw on three basic themes: interpersonal conflict and chaos, clearly defined good and evil, and the grand narrative of all television, an upper middle class worldview that hard work equals affluence, which is available to all. We'll now hear Matt Waddell of Obadiah Parker doing an acoustic cover of the rap song Hey Ya that was featured on the primetime soap Scrubs.
Baby, don't mess around, because she loves me so, at least I know for sure. But does she really wanna, but can't stand to see me walk out the door? I can't stand to fight the feeling, cause the thought alone is killing me right now. Thank God for mom and dad for sticking two together, cause we don't know how. Hey, 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 you think you got it, oh, you think you got it, but got it, just don't get it till there's nothing at all. get together, oh, we get together, but separate's always better when there's feelings involved. If what they say that nothing is forever, what makes love the exception? So why are we so in denial when we know we're not happy? Don't make me break it down for nothing. I wanna see you all on your own, as bad as behavior. I say, lend me some sugar. I am your neighbor. Shake.
That was Matt Waddell doing a cover of the Outkast song Hey Ya, which I didn't especially like in its original version. However, this one has reached cult status with almost 4 million views over the last week due to its use on Scrubs. The book, The Soap Opera Paradigm, was published in 2004, and so the examples are a little out of date, but I can fill in the blanks for my daughters. Along with Scrubs, their favorite soaps are Desperate Housewives, Grey's Anatomy and its spin-off Private Practice, and old episodes of Friends. Soap Opera Paradigm says that 18 to 35-year-olds, and especially college students, are the most targeted demographic because they're entering high-income professions. They tend to watch together, and imagining and commenting on shows becomes a parasocial interaction as the program becomes an alternative to their own lives. However, I think the target audience is far younger, middle and high school age girls in particular. Kids living at home have the most influence over spending of any socioeconomic group. High school students who work have no bills to pay and can spend it all on luxury items. There also seems to be a common theme between the shows that my girls like, a sense of inclusion and security. They all have the acerbic character you love to hate, since the witty put-down is the highest art form on TV. But otherwise, the characters never let anyone in their group slip through the cracks. There's a social safety net in TV soaps for girls, which contrasts with the mean streets of your average high school. By contrast, reality TV celebrates competition, acquisitiveness, and greed. In early examples of one called Big Brother, both the audience and participants worked to foster solidarity and cooperation in meeting the goal, choosing to thwart the producer's intent and share the prize money. The producers changed the rules, introducing hierarchy and arbitrary all-or-nothing prizes. They brought in ex-lovers as participants, which they called the X Factor. Is this reality? Certainly, it's a kind of reality shaped by the capitalism under which TV operates. In this sense, it holds a more accurate mirror up to society of how fear, jealousy, resentment, and conflict can be created against our better nature. How did the news fare in this primetime capitalist behind-the-scenes reality show? By 1998, pumping up the emotion, creating a sense of being there, and emphasizing conflict between good and evil were common news tactics. A dispassionate, analytic approach to the news didn't serve the bottom line. Local crime reporting increased, while actual crime decreased, leading to feelings of greater insecurity. Infotainment played up the human interest stories while ignoring policies and context. One example is the reporting on natural disasters. Witta Bowles compares the presidential visits to two floods in 82 and 97. In 82, the reporting is on the millions of dollars in aid that Reagan was there to okay, with barely a sound clip of him speaking. By 97, the emphasis is on Clinton's moral support to the victims. He gives vapid spiritual pep talks, and the media stands amazed that he takes the time to listen and sympathize. He praises the resiliency of the people, which has replaced statistics and funding for relief. Witta Bowles also looks at a 2003 edition of Dateline as a typical example. The bulk of the two-hour program is a segment called Missing, and I'll quote from the opening part. Her child simply vanished. Her two children disappeared. He lost his past. Tonight they go in search of the missing. She disappeared, like so many others, without a trace. Where did they go? Who would take them? It continues in this vein, titillating listeners with phrases like, a story of love and loss, espionage and intrigue. As parents, many of us fear our children being ripped away from us, from our homes and everything they know and love. For these families, that dark and primal nightmare came true. You later find that this is about a father who took his children back to Cuba, but who were returned by Fidel Castro. Stripped of the geopolitical context, what we learn from the news is that it's a scary, senseless world out there. And that's why insurance companies love to sponsor the news. For Third Paradigm, this has been Teresa Caraggio. Thanks to Skidmark Bob for music production and editing, and to James H. Witta Bowles for his enlightening book, The Soap Opera Paradigm. Our final song is Chumbawamba with Words Can Save Us, from the boys band Have One. Thanks for listening.
April morning, summer comes soon. Clouds follow after. Morning sun is hidden by noon. Day shrouded over. Tears to face the morning news. We watch our future burn and wonder if we'll ever learn that words can save us. War in broken promised land, fame, fear and gunfire. Cowboy culture, blood on its hands. Flag, fuel and empire. Pit parts for shooting stars above the dying trees. No one looking up to see how words can save us. Number one, favorite son, one more outsider. Army drops its cluster bombs. Boy sees his future. World, are you listening now? This fool just had his day. Who'll be brave enough to say that words can save us? World, are you listening now? This fool just had his day. Who'll be brave enough to say that words can save us?